Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guest is Steve Conrad. You know him as the writer of The Secret Life of Walter Mitty and The Weatherman. He is now the creator and writer of Ultra City Smits, now on AMC+. Now join me as we go traversing the stars. Thank you very much, Mr. Conrad, for joining the show. I'm a big fan of yours.
Thank you so much, man. Thanks for asking me.
Oh, it's definitely my pleasure. As I said to you off air, your movie that you wrote, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty with Ben Stiller, is a movie I always watch with my students every year. We read the short story first, and then we watch the movie. And I think it's a great inspirational movie for kids to watch, especially kids who maybe aren't living their life to their fullest.
Thank you. That's very sweet to hear. And as I said to you off screen, I'm on the road, so this is a hotel room. So this is not how I have wallpapered my family room in my home.
No worries. If you don't mind, what are you traveling for?
Oh, I'm headed out. Just headed out to Los Angeles for a little more work. I live in Chicago. So, and then the idea of flying right now with people who wear their masks under their chin.
Yeah.
It's too much for me. So I just drive out. I've done it 6 times since spring 2020. So I'm in Kansas City right now.
Oh, that's very cool. So you're working on something new that you'll be able to share with us at some point?
Yeah, I can't share it tonight.
I know. It's totally okay. There's that part, little part of me is like, push forward. I want to know, but I'll be patient and wait for the information to come out. So you've been in over the course of your career, a successful writer, director, and producer. So when did you first start loving storytelling?
I shared a room with my younger brother, Chris, who's, if you follow our TV series, you'll know Chris Conrad. He's a regular in our cast. And we just grew up together, but we really grew up together. We had twin beds that were 2 feet apart. And he's as funny in real life as he is on screen. So just trying to earn my keep in that bedroom, I had to get a little honed it. Knocking out a pretty good quick little tale. So I guess it started with just trying to make Chris laugh, and my other brothers Tim and Mike are just as funny. And my dad had a pretty good VHS collection, and I don't know, man, it's the same when I talk to my friends who are directors. It's just something about cinema. You just sit there and all of a sudden you think, well, this is it for me. Like, I'm somehow daunting, but somehow I'm gonna jump in and try to figure out how to contribute to this thing.
So you majored in English at the Northwestern University, and you transferred over from Florida State to Northwestern. So what precipitated that transfer, and what did Northwestern teach you about the craft of storytelling?
Nobody's ever asked me that question. It's such a good question. I guess I attribute it to just, when I had always wanted to live in a city, I grew up in the suburbs, and somehow I didn't feel at home ever. And that's not to say that people who live in suburbs can't find meaningful connections and lasting relationships, but only Chris got my jokes, and he split. He was in Chicago already. So I don't know. I wanted to, I play music too. It's the other half of what we do. And the music scene in Chicago was very interesting to me. It had some roots oriented experimental music with cooking. And I really was drawn to that. So I moved to Chicago mostly to get my feet wet in that music scene. And Northwestern was the university that was there. So, and then, writing, just, I found a script that Chris had laying around. It was a Ron Howard movie about Irish immigrants or something. And I read it. I thought, well, I get it. I get it, how this is cobbled together. It makes sense to me. And I was studying writing, and I was studying filmmaking and music. And here it was. There was a world where all these things coalesced. And the music business was very different then. It was sort of open-hearted, and there were many genres that you might explore. Not really the case today, but it was a very exciting field then to be an experimental artist who had more than one art form under their belt.
So in the music industry, what part do you play? I know you do a lot of the songwriting for your show. What did you do in the music scene while in Chicago?
Oh, just played in bad bands and played bad guitar and bad bands. And but songs that were, you know, immature, but I was a kid. And then I started to direct music videos, and next thing I knew, I was just sort of, that became my role there. And I had a family pretty young, and that creates demands on its own. So I would always write songs and at night, and then shoot during the day, write during the day. Yeah, and then, you know, a couple of things clicked, and, you know, for better, for worse, some years better than others, but, you know, it was 30 years have gone by.
So how has your work in music make you a better storyteller? Is there a bridge from your music writing and work to your time as a storyteller and a director?
Well, I think it's made me a better filmmaker, because I can control to, you know, to some extent, and for whatever that's worth, that phenomenon of the audience hearing a piece of music for the first time. It's one thing to cast as your original, your song content, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, and Leonard Cohen, but people have heard those songs, you know, numbering in the hundreds, if not thousands, and they will carry their own connotations into the experience. If you play Tangled Up in Blue in your television series, I don't know that that's going to allow the audience to go deeper into what you're trying to convey. I think it will throw them out into their own relationship to Tangled Up in Blue. So we happened on, this is not just me, I do this with a group the same way I make films, this group of songwriters and friends that I've had forever. We write the original songs now for all the things we do to try to allow that experience to be cohesive and then richer and more deliberate. And we also are hoping to capitalize on that unique feeling that comes from hearing a song for the very first time, as you will in our series, because we don't generally allow the music to get distributed until it's performed in the shows. And it is quite a physical phenomenon to be taken. And this is all assuming it works. It may not, but in the unlikely event it all comes together and it lands for an audience, it is a real physical phenomenon to be taken by a piece of music for the first time. So when we're lighting the scene and we have actors who are in, you know, blocking that you haven't quite seen before in the narrative, you haven't quite experienced before, it just became slightly lazy to me to have a piece of music that you'd also heard before. I wanted to challenge all of us to try to cooperate and make the sound of the thing exist in the moment with the same purpose as what we're shooting. And luckily I have really very, very talented friends who are willing to work at night when I get home from the set. It's music time, and then the Jones sisters gets to write our songs.
So to what you're saying, so making the original music for your projects, does that change, that really changes the energy of the set?
It changes the energy of the viewing experience. Yeah. And the actors often don't know that what I have in mind in terms of the aggregate of all of the things. It's a big enough job for them just to perform with purpose. And I'll often allow them the sort of the grace note to know that they're not in this alone, that we're going to light them and block them and edit them, and then we're going to score them. So the feeling I hope that they, or the deduction I hope they take from that, is they're not in this alone. That everybody knows this already, but often with the way we shoot, it's our actor and then a 35 millimeter camera right in their face, and they can feel very alone, very isolated. And when they know that our group of artists has their back all the way around, I think it allows them to be more comfortable and more peaceful. So the common denominator, I have been asked this before, the common denominator among our series, even our stop motion animation series, is, and this is due to nothing that I direct, they're tremendously well performed by the very best actors who are working, okay? Mm. Across the board, our ensemble is really very, very uniquely strong. And that's very important to me, that department feels like they're protected. And music is one way to do that for them.
Well, when you're writing music, do you find that the music is or you feel more vulnerable with your music than you do the screenwriting, or is each one equally part of your voice?
Well, that's another great question. At some point, you have to pick a melody, and you have to pick a chord progression, you have to pick an arrangement, and then you put all those things together and you say, okay, this is my song. And you can be judged for any one of those, you know, there's 18 things that happen. And then it's a finished thing, but it goes by in a way that people don't evaluate in the moment. When they're watching a human face say something to them, they make a decision instantly whether they believe it or not. And people will check out or check in based on the answer to that question is, do you believe me? So the filmmaking is a high wire act. You only ever cross your fingers and say, I hope this is casting some sort of spell. With music, I think it exists on a kind of a visceral level that we don't really understand yet, but has its own little tricks and devices, but it doesn't live under the microscope that films live under. I mean, I'm guilty of this too. There's actors who I just don't get carried away by. And often that's enough for me to excuse a movie. And I'll say, I can't keep leaning forward because this actor's not drawing me in. And I don't really do that with music. Sometimes if I listen to it, if my kids ask me to listen to something and I have to, you know, with headphones, sit down and really scrutinize it, I'll put that kind of hat on. But anyway, it's such a long-winded answer to your question. I think people feel music and they think about film if you make a mistake. Mm-hmm. If you can keep the hum going, I think the real trick of filmmaking is to try to create a series of images and energy that allows the audience not to question what you're doing, only to feel a feeling at the very end.
Well, I mean, you've had such a successful career, not only as a songwriter with your music, but as a writer. I read that your script, Wrestling Ernest Hemingway, was sold at the age of 19. Is that correct?
No, I was 20. I was 20, almost 21.
Still really young though, to sell your first script.
Yeah, it's funny, when you're that young, you don't feel young. You never feel you never feel young, and then you feel old, and you never feel anything else. It's either of those two feelings. But yeah, that did happen for me pretty young.
And the movie Wrestling Ernest Hemingway, and it was filmed in 1993, and you had names like Richard Harris was in it, Robert Duvall, Sandra Bullock. I mean, for a first script, you had some massive names on that project. I mean, how did that feel? And I mean, the ego of your very first thing and be that, you know, with those kind of names attached to it, must have been immense.
Well, I learned a lot from that experience. Shirley MacLaine was in that cast too. And she and I have gone on to work together again. And that experience was just very, very pretty for me because I was allowed in, or generally you're not once you finish. And Randa Haynes directed that movie, and she happens to have been confident because she's talented. And she knew I wanted to direct, so she was happy to have me around. And then the actors knew that I was trying to learn that the compartmental art of directing performance. And they were very, very generous, and they helped me learn an awful lot. And, you know, the experience was very, very sweet. And then the movie didn't do any business, which that's a roll of dice. You're throwing a dart at a board that's moving, and 30 years later, I still don't have a clue. I don't have a clue why people go or why they stay home or whether they talk about it or bag on it. Who can say? But it didn't do any business, so I got shut down for a spell. And that turned out to be a very, very good thing. Like, I was able to just write for a few years and learn how to write again without having the pressure of having anything produced because nobody was interested. So in very, very early, I learned an awful lot. Then I was allowed to sit and practice. And by the time I was 30 or 31, I had spent many, many hours, you know, thinking about these things. And whereas most people that age have had to work multiple jobs, very frustrating jobs. And my friends who write at night, I have tremendous regard for, because it's all you can do to get through whatever job pays your bills. And at the end of the day, like, that thing's going to wring you dry. And to come home and have a glass of wine and go, okay, now I'm going to write the great American novel. I got so lucky. And really, I think it might have been dumb luck. It really might have been dumb luck. There was a moment where they were making films like that. Aranda was up for something like that. Duvall, one that was challenged by the role he hadn't sort of played before. So anyway, all that did was buy me time. And all the time gave me was practice. And what the practice gave me was some craft. And I hope what craft gave me ultimately was some potency to be able to take any kind of genre and hope that I can tell that campfire story that you tell when you're making movies. Just, okay, here we go. No one's going to talk except me for 2 hours. And then I hope you're going to feel like that was time well spent.
Now, as a screenwriter, when you have actors, like I said, like Robert Duvall, and also Richard Harris, and they're performing your lines, what can you learn as a writer from the actors themselves and watching them perform?
Well, I think you learn to be more spare. I think you learn to leave space for them. I imagine if you screened Wrestling Artist Hemingway and then you screened Patriot, my television series that sort of is our calling card for what we do now, the amount of dialogue the main character has would pale in comparison to the amount of dialogue that those two lead characters have. I think I learned to leave room for the actors to convey through our presence something that I might have failed to do as well with words. When my close friends and I watch anything together, like I just watched the new James Bond last night, and and it's very, very good. Carrie's a genius. You can tell though, when they block into those two spots, that they're going to talk for 5 minutes. Like, just go, oh shit, this is a good time to go and get some ice cream. But you just know that that's what's going to happen. Mm. And I think I wrote like that. I think I would write characters to block into a space, like a diner booth. You go, oh, they're going to talk for 5 minutes. And what I learned by feeling like if I'm a page ahead of the writer, it isn't going to land as strongly. I tried to challenge the settings to not allow the audience to know quite what to expect next, and then to block in a way to put actors together in space where you didn't know how long they were going to share that space, which, you know, creates tension all by itself.
Well, like I said, you're obviously extremely talented. As I said earlier, you wrote one of my favorite movies of all time, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which is based on the short story by James Thurber. What inspired you to adapt that story? And not only what did inspire you, but you obviously looked at that movie from a very different perspective, or the story from a different perspective. I think that many do.
Yeah, well, the opportunity to be able to put on screen your live moment and then the moment of the cycling of your mind, like what has you caught up? Like, what can't you let go of while you try to be in a moment? Mm-hmm. And I paid attention to my own life, and I happened to be almost broke for a little while, and it's all I could think of. And I thought, well, if that's the plight of so many people, and if that's driving you, there's always a second thought. There's always a thing behind the thing. The need to, I don't know, declare some sort of autonomy or power or strength when you really do feel like you're waiting to be stepped on by somebody's heel. Mm-hmm. And the Thurber story seemed to present this occasion where we could do it. And I mean, to say nothing of Stiller, in my opinion, is a director who pushes and challenges and delights in the art form, and works a day and a half every day he works, and demands the most out of himself and then when you watch that, he demands that out of you. So he and I had almost done something before, and then this thing happened, and I thought, man, if I want to shoot my own stuff, but if I'm going to write for somebody else, this guy works as hard as I do, and I think he's got as much talent as I hope to. So let's see what happens. And I really love that movie. And he and I are talking about doing something else just now. He's in a very small group of directors who I would write for these days because I can shoot my own stuff. I would do it for Ben, and I might do it this year. And Gore Verbinski is a guy I learned a lot from on The Weatherman. And he was a mentor for me. And I would write for Gore any day of the week. The common denominator between Stiller and Gore Verbinski is they both love this art form the most. And when they show up, they want to seize a moment and bring a group of people together to make some kind of mark. And not everybody starts there. You do see on a lot of film sets, a lot of directors checking their watches. And I don't know, it's not the way we do it, but I have had that happen on scripts that I've written where I can feel directors just bringing amount of effort that will amount to them just keeping their jobs and nothing more.
Oh. I mean, the movie Secret Life of Walter Mitty, I mean, Ben Stiller inhabited that character extremely well. I think he made that character and the way you wrote that character feel the way I think many of us do feel, that you're stuck in kind of like it's stuck in a rut. You're, you know, in a job that I know he loved his job, but there's like something, an unfulfillment I think he had to his job, I think, to some extent. Maybe he wasn't aware of, but it was there. I don't know if I'm reading that wrong or...
No, you are. But the way I guess we thought about it was that he just wasn't really seen or heard. That he was living a quiet life, and not invisible because he has a sister and a mom and demands, and he's the head of the family. So he has an important and satisfying role to play. But in terms of the larger world, I mean, he works in the sub-basement in the dark, and that wasn't a coincidence. We decided to put him in a dark room and to have him work with just one person. And when I have work jobs other than the one that I do now, I feel like that even at this job sometimes, that you always feel like tomorrow is the day. And you sit there and you think today's the day until 10 a.m.
Yeah.
And then you know it's not. And then you start thinking tomorrow's going to be the day. And that's true of Walter Mitty's life. And until it's unsustainable, until that the drive of Walter to be recognized and heard just overwhelms the day. It takes control of the day. And I mean, I thought he just did such a beautiful job of conveying a person who is meeting the needs of people that he loves, but also feels driven to create a little more a space where he can call home that wasn't the home he grew up in. And I thought that might just be the drive of every young man or woman's life, is to strike out and make your own home, to respect the one you were raised in and take care of the people who raised you, but then also to strike out enough so that you feel like you can, you know, have controlled circumstances enough to say, this is my home as a grown person. And that should be different than the one you were raised in. So that was what Walter Mitty was to me. And I really liked that film.
I can't stress just how great I think it is. Like I said, I watch it every year with my students after we read the short story. And the school which I teach is a therapeutic school of a lot of students with anxiety who don't leave the house, who don't, you know, go home, sit in a dark room all day when they get home and leave the building. And I watched Secret Life of Walter Mitty with them. And one of the things I love about it is that it does try to encourage, I think, not being afraid to live life, to go out there, reach for experiences, you know. And it's a beautiful movie, and it's a beautifully written movie.
Well, I like that as a place to kind of study where you're at in a moment, like the decision to leave the house or not. I think people who spend a tremendous amount of time alone are very smart. Both of my kids have recently gotten their driver's license, and each of them, independent of the other, said to me, you know, when you start driving, you really, and they both live in Chicago, and you really learn that half of the people are just, they're dicks. They don't follow the rules. They're unashamed of that. They're obnoxious. They're loud. They're, you know, violent. So pretty safe deduction about life on Earth in 2021. Get on a bus, look around. Like, I get wanting to stay home. His work environment that is douched down from Adam Scott to like that, I don't think that's a comic exaggeration. Like, I am thinking back on my bosses now are all studio executives, but yeah. Man, it feels like that. It just feels like you just don't have any idea why you're here. You're just here. You're wearing a suit, yeah. You're tying your shoes, and you came in the door and you're going to leave through the door. But what you did in between those two things, I didn't notice. But so I get wanting to isolate or to be private. I think it's a sign that you have a soul or you're sensitive. Anyway, it was true of him. He is a tremendously sensitive person. But in any regard, I guess I feel like anybody who has any value maybe would be able to say that about themselves.
And like I said, I often wonder about Mitty after that script. Do you think about the character? Like, what you would be after the moment the movie ends as an individual?
Yeah, I don't, you know, because it helps me end. If I allowed myself to get carried into that, I would still be writing it. And, you know, he's not real. He only exists from page one to page 118. And I know people like that who have found, when kids struggle in high school to find friendships, I think what they're hoping for is, well, picture like a music video. And these music videos haven't changed since I was a kid. It's lead singer and then dance ensemble. But the energy is that singer, that these are all their personal friends, and they're in sync with all of the movements of their body and their message in the song, and that this unit behind them is eight people deep, and they're all doing the same thing. I think when you're a kid, you expect that that's the number of friends you're going to have, and that's how you're going to walk through life. Yeah. And I expected that and didn't have it, and I think my kids did. And I remember their mom just saying, you need a friend, but you just need one, right? That's what you need, and that's enough, right? But you got to get that, and if you don't have it, you have to get it. And I think Walter has Cheryl. He's got one friend, and then you know how that goes. Then there's resonating circles of other people, and God, was that her name in the movie? It's been so long.
I'm trying to remember, but you know what? It sounds right. It sounds right to me, so run with it.
Well, Kristen's character in any event, he has her, and you know, he had to go around the world to be able to get to there. So I think he's there inside of that one friendship. And then what happens next, who can say?
So one thing I always wondered about this movie, once again, a lot of the movie takes place at the headquarters of Life Magazine. And Life Magazine actually went out of business in the year 2000. The movie was done in 2013. Did you, in making the script, did you have to get permission to use Life Magazine?
Yes.
You did. I always wondered about that.
Definitely. And that was a harrowing few weeks, because if they said no, I don't know what we would have done. And probably that's attributable to Ben being extremely charming.
Yeah.
But they ended up saying yes.
I mean, if they said no, the movie would have been extremely different looking, I imagine.
Yeah, I would have had to start over on a script.
Yeah. Like I said, I love to see your life with Walter Mitty. And because of that movie, I checked out another one of your projects, current one from AMC, called Ultra City Smiths, which is a very fascinating series. It's very funny. I was trying to think of the best way to define the series, and I couldn't do it. It seems to defy like an easy definition of what it is.
Yeah, it's just good, clean fun. I think we take baby dolls and costume them as grown-ups and then create an urban environment around them that's, you know, 1970s crime-infested New York, and have them try to band together to solve a murder case. And it's a musical, and it's yeah, it's something else. Ultra City Smith. It's, you know, the dolls are this big, but the world's just exponentially great.
So, what inspired you, I mean, to make City Ultra City Smiths the way you did with, like I said, with the baby dolls? I mean, was it a reaction to COVID and not being able to be around each other? Was
that allowed us to be a show, because I think they made the show because we could shoot it with COVID, but we had it was in, you know, development forever. But that really stemmed from me wanting to just go deeper, the same way that we decided I was gonna get with my musical friends and we were gonna try to contribute music to my stuff. I started to become fascinated with the way people walk and the way they drink tea and the way they brush their hair. Now, if you direct actors on a day like that, like if I did that all day long to Jackie Weaver and Jimmy Simpson on Perpetual Grace, we couldn't shoot what we have to shoot. I have to give them space to be able to do all those things alone. But in the world of stop motion animation, those are all the decisions that my co-director and I, David Brooks, make. So I happen to think that the way you drink tea says as much about your confidence level as what you're about to say. And your walk when you're walking into a room and walking out of it will be very different. And I can't do that with actors, but I can do it with our figures. So Ultra City for me became a way for me to make clouds and make shoelaces and do walks and be able to choreograph dances and to make a musical where I could control all the characters that move and speak. And it's a tremendously time consuming.
I bet.
And then it's over in a flash. Like you watch it and you think it just kind of, it's just happening in some weird corner of Oz. There's the bad neighborhood in Oz. They're doing this, but it's really very, very satisfying.
The way the movie is, like I said, with the way you use the baby dolls, and the movie has some definitely dark corners to it, some definitely dark humor, some absurdist humor as well. Could the story have been told this way with real actors instead of the baby dolls? Like, what did
that? I think that's a great way into what we're trying to do. We make comedy based on the silly physicality of the dolls or their limitations or their attributes, like to be able to make them do things human bodies can't do. What comedy we have comes from manipulating the dolls in the art form of stop motion animation. I don't think that would be an exciting story if it were told by, but in that respect, it shouldn't be. Like, you should make a demand on the elemental aspect of the art form. The same if you were writing a ballet, you wouldn't jam a ballet with dialogue. You leave space for there to be a feeling that's expressed through dance. We leave a lot of space to express a feeling through the animation of these bodies. But the inspiration for me was always Chuck Jones cartoons, where their human bodies are exaggerated and they had to think of heartbeats. They had to think of how you gain momentum when you start to run, what happens when you stop too short. The feeling when you have love at first sight, and your eyes don't really do this, but that you couldn't do that with real actors, but you watch that in animation and it expresses a feeling that you recognize, but it's a brand new demonstration of a familiar feeling. And I think that's what art is. So the stop motion world allows us to be able to do that, to convey feelings that you recognize through means you haven't quite seen before. And I hope that we run into a studio executive who's brave enough to keep doing it. But we'll see.
I mean, I kind of wonder what it would be like to be the fly on the wall when you are pitching this story to produce. Once again, using the baby dolls and the storyline. Oh,
we shot so much of it. We did a long, long prototype.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my co-creators, Jeff Dieter and Tom Glenn and I, we've been working on this for 12 years.
Oh, wow.
And we started in Jeff's garage in Chicago. moved to a loft space, and then we, were able to get, six episodes out of AMC. And so no one could see, we had to just do it. That's true of really very good animation. If you are an animator and a filmmaker who wants to work in this world, I would encourage you to go onto YouTube and just watch the origin stories of how these things you love came to be, Triplets of Belleville, whatever. You have to put in so much work to make people who will give you the money to make it see it. And they aren't people who can conceive these things from scratch. They don't see the world the way filmmakers do, which is okay because they have to go and make $40 million and then give it to you. And I can't do that. Mm. So, but we had to do it first, and we had to do it in beta. So it looked bad. The hair was patchy. It looked like Team America. But there was enough going on there where you could see that it could work if you had the time and the resources.
And it's produced by the Robot Chicken people. Is that correct? Matthew Seinrich, yes. And Seth Green as well, or is it just Matthew Seinrich?
I think it's all a Stupid Buddy. And they've kind of cornered the market on that art form, which is good because they were a great, great partner for us. And we really did get the time, which, that's the name of the game in stop motion, is we shoot 8 seconds per set per day. So on a daily basis, there'll be one environment with our lead characters all day long to animate. And you come home with 8 seconds of footage. So you have to have multiple sets in the 30s and the 40s, and it becomes a herding cats to corral that kind of energy. And then you watch it and it seems childish, but there's so much grown up energy that.
There are a lot of levels to it. Like I said, there's some very, very serious aspects of that film. I mean, of the series. And, with the humor tied in, you do a great job, I think, of balancing some real ideas, adult ideas with, the absurdity of the baby dolls and the dance numbers and everything else. And it's a really ingenious script. Like I said, I don't know how I would explain to someone who hasn't seen it, but it's absolutely amazing to watch.
Well, it's weird enough that Tom Waits decided to be the narrator.
About to say, your voice cast is amazing. You've got Kristen Bell, Tom Watts, Terry O'Quinn, and there's more people who I didn't write down, but there's a lot of really amazing talent. Your brother is the protagonist.
Yeah, I mean, Dave Einger, Randolph, Jimmy Simpson, Damon Harriman, Kerwood Smith, Dax Shepard, Kristen Bell, and Alia Shawkat. I'm going to leave Dana DeLorenzo, Louis Guzman, who is a collaborator of mine. Tim Heidecker, Tim Meadows, the list, they were drawn to the thing, I think, because of the other things that we've made together, Elephant Pictures, Patriot and Perpetual Grace. And it's a real compliment to my very large group who makes those shows that they would trust that this could work, because this could have gone terribly wrong. Baby dolls creep people out. But somehow ours got over it somehow.
Well, another thing, like I said, because you're using baby dolls and like I said, and the style in which the show is shot, how do you make it so the audience is identifying with the baby dolls and takes them as characters in the story? And you know what I'm saying? How are you able to do that?
We start by recording the actors. So Jimmy and my brother, the same way they share scenes in Perpetual Grace Limited, they perform the scenes organically at a microphone, and then we animate after we have those captures. We don't show them any conceptions until we have their performances, and they are pretty straight up. And the straighter they are, the more crooked the world can be. So they come in and just sort of do their thing. And many of them I have worked with in multiples, and they're very used to the rhythms of the dialogue or the contours of the shape of the scene, where the absurdity is or the fun or the message or, the relief. My brother knows that like the back of his hand, and so does Jimmy by now. So they give us that thing, and then we edit it like a radio play. And then as soon as that works, as performed by our cast, then we think, well, how can we animate this to draw out X, Y, and Z, to draw out these pauses, these breaths, the heartbreak, if you hear it in somebody's voice, how do you animate? And are the bodies of our dolls, we can allow their chest to increase and decrease to suggest breaths. And we can manipulate the movement of their eyes organically. There's so much they can do. And you realize ultimately that people have just a very small, they have a handful of ways to express many, many things. And you can recognize them all. They're not quite micro signals, like those things you pick up on a partner or a friend that make you feel like they're worried or they're happy. You can recognize those and the dolls can perform them. They're not all that complicated. You just have to know them when you see them.
So as a writer, what is the most challenging aspect to engage your audience in a story, like in a series like this? What was your most challenging aspect of that?
Well, for me, stop motion has a lot of connotations. It's got like Rankin and Bass, Frosty the Snowman energy, and it can start to feel childish right away. So we're making adult entertainment. So having to put a world around them that instantly allowed you to feel like you're not in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer territory. And so score, Alex Roman, who's a composer that I use all the time, his score you could attach that score to any live action cinema that was 70s oriented, and it would feel great. And then Tom Waits carrying us through the show. He's not Burl Ives. I mean, he's Tom Waits. And when you hear his voice, you start thinking grown-up thoughts. And he was a huge, like the levee broke when Tom joined the show in terms of the potency of what we could do with these baby dolls. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge favor to me and leap of faith on his part. But that's true of everybody in our cast. They didn't know what the thing was going to look like when they signed up to do it.
Well, like I said, Tom Waits, I mean, the quality of his voice is amazing. I mean, there's so much layers of just experience, and you know, there's so much going on in that voice that of someone who seems like has lived a very deep life.
So Tom gets us started, and then Deborah Winger comes. And when Deborah Winger's in there, she does the very same thing. Like she just allows that thing to feel more important than it would otherwise. And Bibi Newworth is Lady Andrea the Giant, and she does the very same thing. So we very carefully selected and then got really very lucky that these actors were willing to do it. But choosing the right voice cast to try to allow that thing to have, you know, grown-up shapes to it when you processed it was imperative. And so building the world, lighting the world, casting the actors, and then letting them go and be themselves, and then building the dolls after they were themselves was really the trick on Ultra City.
So Ultra City Smith has had six episodes so far, and it ends on a cliffhanger. Are we guaranteed further episodes from the series? Is that in the can?
You're never guaranteed anything. I mean, it came out great. Like the reception of it was very warm. Mm. Now, having said that, these are business people. I don't know them. So we make it, they sell it. So I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do. I mean, people really like it, and it got over in terms of the people who could have stepped on it and killed it, thought people ought to give it a chance. But there's a studio executive that I've almost worked with that I haven't yet, named John Landgraf, who's at FX. And John, I mean, he's made multiple shows that are part of the American fabric, but John made Always Sunny, and nobody watched Always Sunny the first year. Nobody. And, you know, Danny DeVito came to the cast in the second season just to raise their profile. And Danny DeVito didn't change that show. They changed Danny DeVito. And they just kept doing what they were doing gradually, you know. So what you hope for when you encounter a new set of studio executives, you hope that they recognize that quality and time equals value. quality in 3 months is an X factor. Who knows? But if you bet on those kids from Always Sunny, you won. If you bet on Matt and Trey from South Park, you won. If you give somebody who has that kind of ambition enough time, you're going to come out of it with a thing that's very, very valuable. And I want to meet that person someday. I don't know if that's where we're at here. We'll see. But that's my dream partner, is someone who says, you just go, you make it as well as you can make it. Let us worry about selling it. We didn't have that Patriot. They didn't produce screeners for the show to win awards. They didn't have any kind of screenings for any press. They didn't send, you know, burns of the thing to the Directors Guild or the Writers Guild. I didn't do a thing on that show. And there was 110 well-meaning people who wanted to keep making that show. And the people ultimately who decided whether it was going to live or die didn't have a connection to it. I don't know. We'll see. If it was up to me, I'd make 20 years of Ultra City. But unfortunately, it's not up to me.
So when do you think you would know, or they'll let you know when or whether it's greenlit or not?
That's the other thing. They're just little dolls sitting in boxes. They're not getting other jobs, so they get fired back up. I might, though, so who can say? But I don't know. It's 6 months from now. I guess the writing will be on the wall. But the show did well, and people like it. So let's see. It is an unusual 23 minutes.
Yes. But it's a fun 23 minutes, though. I mean, it's, like I said, it's very entertaining. It works on multiple levels. And it's unlike anything you probably have seen on TV, you know, when you start watching it.
Maybe that's true. One of the cruel aspects of the thing. They asked me to write the second season. So I have to figure out what we're doing, and then I have to write it. And then they still don't tell me whether we're making it. So I know Lady Andrea the Giant, what her song is like, what she sings about. And so when I write it, I can't write it unless I really picture it, unless I know I can produce it.
Yeah.
So I draw and I write. And then when I'm done with the scripts, I kind of see it. Mm. And I've seen the whole second season. Like I know where the tension is. I know where the reward is. I know how my brother comes back, and I can't wait for that. But anyway, I did my work on it. So we'll see.
Well, like I said, I really enjoyed the series. And like I said, our listeners can find it on AMC, AMC Plus, which I think you can access through Amazon as well. So everyone should check out Ultra City Smits. It's totally worth watching. Give it my 2 thumbs up approval.
Thank you.
And Mr. Cameron, I thank you so much for talking with me. It was a great pleasure. And I think you're fascinating to listen to.
Oh, thank you very much. I thought your questions were really thoughtful and provocative. So I enjoyed the time. And I want to apologize again for my setting.
Oh, no worries.
My green chair, my green wallpaper.
Well, you know, the great thing about it, though, it's not distracting at all. You know, people are not looking around at your background. They're listening right just to you.
All right, cool. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, sir.
All right, stay well.
You as well.